Welcome to episode 2 of the Women in the Can competition season of the Seventh Row podcast, or Women at Can for short. I'm your host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row, and joined by my co-host, our executive editor, Orla Smith.
Hello.
This year is quite exciting at Can because, well, exciting by Can standards, because they have actually put 5 or 4.5 films directed by women in competition, which, no matter how you count it, is still more than any previous year. They are still way behind basically every other festival except maybe Venice, and far from gender parity, but we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate the many wonderful, talented women filmmakers and their really excellent films that have been feted by the competition, both this year and in the past. And part of the impetus for doing this season is actually the subject of this week's episode, which is director Kelly Reichardt, who is making her Cannes competition debut this year. And we wrote a book on her films, not including this film, but every other film up to it, and her process called Roads to Nowhere. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to talk about Kelly's Cannes competition debut, what this means for her career, and why we think this honor is long overdue. So this is, as I said before, this is the second episode of a 4-part season on the Cannes competition. You can go back and listen to our first episode, which was sort of an overview of the history of women directors at the Cannes Film Festival in competition and beyond, going way back to the inception of the festival. And we have coming up 2 more episodes. Next week on May 25th, we'll be talking about Celine Sciamma, her film Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which screened in competition in 2019, and her history with the festival. And then we'll close out our little season on Women in the Cannes competition on June 1st in 2 weeks, when we will be talking about the darling of Cannes, Japanese filmmaker Naomi Kawase, who has screened at Cannes more times than any other woman, and has screened, like, in competition more times than most filmmakers. There are very few that can top her in the last 20 years. So for today's discussion on Kelly Reichardt and her big year at Cannes, which is the opening of what we're calling the Year of Kelly Reichardt, more on that to come, we have with us our contributing editor, Lindsay Pugh.
Hello.
And Lindsay actually wrote an essay in our ebook on Kelly Reichardt on Meek's Cutoff. So maybe you can introduce yourself briefly with your history of Kelly Reichardt.
I actually don't remember what the first Kelly Reichardt movie I saw was. Maybe Wendy and Lucy, or maybe Old Joy. I'm not sure, but I've been a fan of her work for a long time, have seen all of her movies, and weirdly enough, I thought after writing this essay on Meek's Cutoff that I would hate it because I watched it so many times to write the essay, but I think now I would probably say it's my favorite Kelly Reichardt movie. I think I kind of underrated it almost in her filmography.
I will say your essay on Meek's Cutoff was a big contributor to why the first time I saw Meek's Cutoff, I was like, I don't get it. I don't see why people like this. Oh my God, this is an amazing film.
Yeah, me too. Same thing.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if it's my favorite of her films, but it's definitely maybe like top 3. And that's very much thanks to your essay.
Yeah, there's just something about that movie that is so dark and intriguing to me, and I feel differently about it every time I watch it.
So I've alluded to this already, that we wrote a book on Kelly Reichardt and her work, and it's called Roads to Nowhere. You can get it on our website at reichardtbook.com, and it is the only non-academic book on the market that is on, well, first of all, it's the only non-academic book on the market on Kelly's work. And it's also the only book, period, that covers all of Kelly's work leading up to showing up and talks about her filmmaking process, because we actually did in-depth interviews with her entire creative team in front of and behind the camera to give you the inside look at how a Kelly Reichardt film is made. The book also has some really wonderful behind-the-scenes images some Polaroids courtesy of her cinematographer on First Cow, Christopher Blofeld. We've got these little Polaroids from the making of that film. And finally, the book has essays on Kelly's films, which include Lindsay's essay on Meek's Cutoff and several essays on Certain Women and First Cow. So you can get a copy of the book again at reichartbook.com. The book is also part of our Women in the Can competition box set if you want to get three books for the price of two and get books on Celine Sciamma and You Were Never Really Here as well. And we'll put links to that in the show notes. Orla, do you want to start us off with who is Kelly Reichardt?
Kelly Reichardt is, well, we've written a short synopsis here, and I like that it starts with Kelly Reichardt is one of the great directors working today, which is a fact. Who decided? Certainly, she is probably my favorite working director. She is from Florida, actually, despite the fact that she's known mainly for making films set in, say, Oregon and Certain Women in Montana, in that kind of area of America. But she hails from Miami, and she teaches currently at Bard College. And ever since the 2000s, she's been making movies, as I said, in the American West. She's been writing and directing movies for almost 30 years now. Her first film, River of Grass, was released in 1994, I believe. Yes, 1994. It was at Sundance in 1994. But she didn't make a film for 12 years after that, due to sort of a combination of the extreme sexism of the film industry and an unwillingness to make the kinds of films that she wanted to make. She sort of spent a while making short films and just working out ways to hone her craft and just get by until she could make Old Joy in 2006, which was her second feature. We actually named Reichardt's film Certain Women the number two film of the 2010s, and it's one of my favourite films. Then obviously we wrote a book about her last film, First Cow, which I think her profile has been very slowly rising over the past three decades, and it's kind of depressing how slow that rise had to be, but it's nice to see that she's getting a bit more critical attention now. First Cow topped a lot of critics' best of the year lists, and it was produced by A24, who are obviously very hot right now, and as was showing up, and they gave her a bigger budget than she's had on any other film and more freedom to work.
And I think importantly, with just as far as the critics' lists go and her first slot in the competition, First Cow is the number one film of the year according to Cahiers du Cinéma, which is the French film criticism publication in France. So that was like the first time she suddenly became a huge deal in France, and it came out in 2021, and look, 2022, she's in competition.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really excited to see what new heights her career arise to with this new film showing up, because suddenly people are starting to recognize that Kelly Reichardt is pretty great, which is, as always, a bittersweet feeling of like, why did it take you so long? But also, I'm glad.
So I guess with that in mind, we have been dubbing 2022 the year of Kelly Reichardt, because a lot of really exciting stuff is happening for Kelly Reichardt this year. The first, kicking that off, is her first slot in the Cannes competition was showing up. She, at Cannes this year also, they're going to be screening Meek's Cutoff in the director's fortnight. And the fortnight is going to give her the Carros d'Or, and she's going to be giving a masterclass there. So that's already like a lot of Cannes fet. Later in the year, the Locarno Festival, they've already announced this, that they're going to be giving her the honorary Golden Pard. Again, an award sort of recognizing her lifetime achievement. She's still super young for lifetime achievement, but we'll take it.
Well, she's been struggling to get those kind of awards for a while. So
exactly.
She deserves them.
And it seems like showing up might be a bit more mainstream than some of her other films. It helps that it's got, like, Michelle Williams, Andre 3000. Not that John Magaro is really Mr. Mainstream here.
Andre 3000 is weirdly, like, so in with the Cannes directors. Like, he was in a Claire Denis film with High Life, who's now in the Cannes competition this year, and now he's in a Kelly Reichardt film. It's just a very, I'm happy for him.
So, I mean, this is Kelly's first time in competition at Cannes, but this is not the first time she has been at Cannes. She was actually a jury member for the official competition in 2019, which you may recall is when Parasite won, and she has screened one previous film in the official selection in the Un Certain Regard section, which was Wendy and Lucy in 2008, which of course also stars Michelle Williams. Most of her films, though, have premiered at other festivals. She has gone to Sundance several times with her first two films, River of Grass and Old Joy, and then she came back again with Certain Women. And she has also screened a bunch of times at Venice in their competition with Meek's Cutoff and Night Moves. The word is that the Venice competition wanted First Cow, but A24 said no. So First Cow actually ended up premiering at Telluride before playing Berlin. I guess it played New York and then Berlin, and kind of made the rounds at other European film festivals throughout 2020 and 2021. In whatever form those took, because First Cow's release was like the week of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think it had like half of a week in cinemas or something, and then the lockdown hit.
I remember there was a press screening in Toronto, and then like a week later it was the pandemic, so that was wild.
Yeah, it's funny because you can never know sort of like the reasons people weren't at Cannes. Perhaps she just didn't want to screen her films at Cannes. So I never know whether to be mad that like Kelly Reichardt's only now in the Cannes competition with her eighth feature. Because,
well, you know, Cannes goes after, every festival goes after directors they like to. So if Cannes wanted her in competition, I'm sure they could have had her earlier. They could have courted her, and they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think a good kind of like analog of a older director who I feel like I know Kelly Reichardt is inspired by and who feels a bit of a piece of her is Chantal Ackerman, in the sense that they're both sort of like dealing with slow cinema that like follows the process of women's lives and observes them quite quietly. We talked in the last episode about how Chantal Ackerman was never once in the Cannes competition. And it feels, maybe perhaps it's a sign of change that someone who is quite similar to Ackerman is now in the competition, but it's also frustrating that it takes a while for like, Cannes is quite reluctant to, I mean, they like to acknowledge art house cinema and they do like to acknowledge slow cinema when it's about certain things. Like they'll acknowledge endurance test films usually that are about like men doing serious things, but they're not as likely to acknowledge a slow film that is just observing the interior lives of women,
unless they're crazy,
considered to be, unless they, yeah. But it's like if they're doing something like not super super dramatic and off the wall and also directed by men, then it's not considered important enough.
Well, and I think also what we learned in our last episode is it's very, very common for women to screen at Cannes once and never again. Mm-hmm. And we don't know why that is. We don't know. Did they have such a terrible experience they never submitted again? Did they keep submitting and not get selected? But on our list of directors who screened at Cannes once and never again, you have Gillian Armstrong, whose first film was in competition, never went back to Cannes. Then we have over in Directors Fortnight and Critics Week, Agnieszka Holland, Patricia Rosema. I mean, there's many more, but those are just like a few of the, I think, like pretty well-known, prolific, excellent women directors working today who are not of the Cannes set Or, you know, they went there once. And why didn't they go back? We don't know.
Are there men who fit into that category who are well known, who only screened once and then not again?
I don't know the answer to that question, really, because we'd have to dig through the history, but I think unlikely. Because I'm trying to think, like, think of it. Can you think of a male filmmaker who's super well known who hasn't screened at Cannes multiple times?
No.
So
I don't know that for a fact, but
no, I mean, I don't know it for a fact either, but I'm just thinking, if you think of the most, well, maybe David Fincher hasn't screened at Cannes. That wouldn't surprise me because he makes sort of mainstream movies.
Oh, I think he screened Zodiac in competition, maybe 2007.
Yeah, he did. He did.
So, okay. But so he's only been in competition once. Poor Fincher hasn't been recognized by Cannes.
poor guy.
But, like, I mean, I think if you think of, like, men who have been nominated for Oscars, men who are really well-known or box office successes, most of them, they've made a couple of films, have screened at Cannes at least once, and probably more than once. Like, even Baz Luhrmann, he, like, shits out a film and it's glamorous, so they screen his stuff.
And you see, obviously, Ken, like, pursuing men a lot earlier in their careers than they have someone like Kelly Reichardt. Like, I think an interesting counterexample is Sean Baker, because he's also American. He also shows, like, the lives of working class Americans in his films. And he's also, A24 manages his films, just like Kelly Reichardt's last two. And his last two films have both been in Cannes and the last one in competition, even though he's, you know, he's younger, earlier career, been working for less time than Kelly Reichardt has. But there's just something a bit more attractive about lifting up someone like him to Cannes than there is someone like Kelly Reichardt, it seems. Not that I think he's bad, but I obviously prefer Kelly Reichardt's film.
Yeah, well, and I mean, she's got the multiple strikes against her for inclusion in Cannes, right? Like, she doesn't put major male stars in her films, generally. She makes films, a lot of her films are about working class people, and she's not named Ken Loach, or Mike Lee, or Jean-Pierre Luc Dardenne, so they don't need her for that. And she's a woman, and she's not an actress.
Yeah, and with regards to, like, her, like, depicting working class lives, but she does so in a way that's, like, not sensationalized in any way, and it's also not stylistically drawing attention to themselves, her films.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you could argue someone like Sean Baker is drawing attention to himself stylistically in quite a strong way. Like, his films are very kind of saturated and focused on the 35mm of it all.
To be fair, I'm not sure going to Cannes with her previous films would have helped her career, because I don't think Cannes is a good place for thoughtful cinema.
Yeah. That's the flip side of it.
Which that's not even just, I'm not just talking about, like, whether they program it, but at least the way it operated in the old days, it's been a bit different since the pandemic. Now there are reserved seating. But, like, it's sort of a miserable existence, you know. They have graduated press passes, so you know how unimportant you are to the festival, and that determines which lineup you're in. You stand in a queue outdoors in the beating sun for 2 hours, so by the time you get, and it's, like, May in Cannes, so it's 30 degrees outside, then by the time you get into the film, if you get in, because if you've got a shitty press pass and it's a popular film, you might not get in. By the time you get in, you're dehydrated, hungry, and tired. And this is and you're in a cinema that is underventilated, under air conditioned, full of hot bodies with very little space, because their cinemas are, like, more cramped than I would say the average North American cinema. And that is the situation in which you sit down to watch, like, a 2 to 3 hour contemplative film. Like, it's not a surprise that films like Louder Than Bombs got destroyed at Cannes. And I could see, like, imagine Meek's Cutoff going to Cannes and people being like, they just did the laundry. How boring. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, it would, with the heat, it would be a bit of a 4D experience.
Well, so that's that. True. But I guess I just mean, like, I mean, certainly our experience too has been that I didn't necessarily immediately click with all of her films. Like, I did with certain women, that was instant love. But with several of her other films, it was like I had to see them more than once to really think about yes. them and talk about them and understand them. And that's just not the environment that Cannes offers. So I guess the flip side of complaining that they haven't recognized her is it might have been bad for her to have been there earlier in yeah. her first quote-unquote comedy, though we'll talk about how all her films are comedies, is maybe a good film to be at Cannes, sort of like how Worst Person in the World was a good film to have in competition because it was like easy and popular. And could do well in a way that, say, Louder Than Bombs couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point. I think it's a really difficult conversation to have, like, this whole season, really, where it's like, why aren't these women being invited to Cannes? We have to balance that against, like how important is Cannes, really?
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like the institution is bad because they don't think as critically and carefully as we'd want about like how to program and how to actually appreciate the art. A better institution would be interested in these people, but the mm-hmm. institution as it is isn't necessarily the most nurturing place for these kinds of films and these kinds of filmmakers. So
yeah.
I think you're right. I don't think Kelly Reichardt would be in it's difficult. Kelly Reichardt wouldn't be in a better place in her career from my perspective as a viewer and as a fan of hers if she had been in Cannes earlier. However, I mean, if she had had a high profile film that was successful at Cannes, I mean, maybe things would have been easier for her, which is the flip side of it.
I mean,
she's spoken vocally about how much she has struggled to get money for her films, and even when she's gotten enough money to make a film, it's still been a grueling set because they still don't have enough to make it a comfortable experience. And the kind of prestige that Cannes slots do give you is the kind of prestige you can leverage for a more comfortable and fruitful career, which, I mean, she certainly struggled a lot. And even though I think she's in a decent place as a filmmaker now, comparatively, you still need to acknowledge like how grueling that struggle was and how she shouldn't have needed to prove her worth that many times over.
Yeah, I think the other way of looking at it too is that maybe the competition might have not been helpful to her, but I could see Directors Fortnight could have been friendly to her in the past, and they have a history of programming films that do well at Sundance. You know, they did with Deborah Granik's, I think, Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace, both premiered at Sundance, and then they played at the Directors Fortnight. So they could have taken River of Grass, Old Joy, and Certain Women. I mean, who knows why they didn't, whether they didn't chase after it, she didn't submit it, you know. Would it have been better to premiere Meek's Cut Off at Directors Fortnight, because then she wouldn't have been able to screen in Venice competition. I mean, there's all kinds of complicated politicking in there, but I guess the reason why it's really of note is because a big part of the way that the old boys club of cinema still works is that the canon is very much kind of formed through Cannes. Even if you look at, you know, I was starting to go through Brett's list of the women directors who have screened at Cannes, and it's like the easiest films to find are the ones that have screened in competition. Like, many of those are on Criterion Channel. If you start, like, looking back at obscure film by a woman who's, like, not Chantal Ackerman from 1970, good luck. Those are a lot harder to find. And I think also there's a big difference, too, between how important Cannes is for American filmmakers versus international filmmakers, because American filmmakers have other recourses, right? Like Sundance, which is where
women premiere.
Exactly. And River of Grass and Old Joy. And so Kelly Reichardt used those. Those are really good launching platforms for Americans and American cinema, like if you want to be considered for Oscars. Not that that's the be-all, end-all, but it unfortunately is a big part of how you raise your profile and get well known, get your film seen, have options in your career,
get money.
Yeah, which is part and parcel with all of those things.
Yeah.
Is Oscars. And so for international filmmakers, I mean, if you look back at the list of Oscar nominees from the last, I don't know, decade, say, like, most of them were at Cannes. Like, last year we had, what, even from the short list, a bunch of them were at Cannes, but, like, certainly Drive My Car, that was in Cannes competition. Worst Person in the World was in the Cannes competition. Flea was selected by Cannes in 2020, the year that it didn't happen. So it was Cannes-feted. Lunana, well, that was an outlier. And then what was the other one?
The Hand of God, which is Venice. Right,
which is Venice.
Which is an Italian film, so Venice makes sense.
Yeah.
But then in the shortlist, you have, you know, all sorts of films.
Right.
That, you know, were Cannes players as well.
Well, and if you look at which of those foreign films got nominated more than once outside of the foreign language category, they were all Cannes films.
Two of the Cannes ones.
No, well, three, yeah. Right? If you include Flea, it was all Cannes films that were nominated outside of the international feature slot. So I think it's like getting that competition slot is maybe more important for international directors, although look at Naomi Kawase and you can't find her. Well, now you can find her films in North America. They're on the they're streaming on the Criterion Channel now. Films that have screening competition that have been unavailable for like a decade or more, you can actually now finally see in North America, but that was not true for a very long time. We'll get into that more in episode 4, but
yeah, it's almost the opposite for American filmmakers, where, like, if you're an international director, going to Cannes can help you to break out into, like, the American Oscar-y thing. And if you're an American filmmaker, going to Cannes is saying, I'm not just, like, your average American filmmaker who wants an Oscar. I'm also, like, art house.
I'm not just a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
Yeah, exactly. In 2020, when First Cow was released, we wrote an ebook on Kelly's work called Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams. Here's what critics have to say about Roads to Nowhere. As a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough. That's Claudio Alves at The Film Experience. Christopher Schobert at The Film Stage said, breathtaking in its insight. And Sheila Rowan Legg at Screen Anarchy said, a terrific read for anyone who loves and studies both the filmmaker and contemporary independent American cinema. You can get a copy of the book at ReichardtBook.com, and you can also get our Kelly Reichardt mug to sit from while you read the book. It's also available at ReichardtBook.com. Roads to Nowhere offers the first in-depth 360-degree look at Reichardt's process through interviews with Reichardt herself and her collaborators on First Cow, many of whom have been working with her for years. Roads to Nowhere is the only non-academic book on the market on Kelly's work and the only book covering all of her work leading up to showing up, as well as her filmmaking process. The book has in-depth interviews with her entire creative team in front of and behind the camera, behind-the-scenes images, and insightful essays. Again, you can get a copy at ReichardtBook.com, or you can get a copy as part of the Women in the Can competition box set, which you can find at 7th-rome.com/womenatcan.
Okay, I feel like we should actually talk about Kelly Reichardt now and her work.
No. Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, I don't know. When you were talking about Naomi Kawase briefly, that made me think of Kelly Reichardt kind of compared to her, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that more in the Kawase episode, but I feel like they do some similar things in their introspection. And that's why it is interesting to me that Kawase has been frequently on the Cannes scene, although panned a lot of times by critics and has gotten a lot of terrible pushback. And I think that's interesting because she and Reichardt, not that they are similar filmmakers, but I think they are similarly introspective in their filmmaking. And I understand why people would see it and maybe say, this isn't for me, or this is boring, or I don't understand what it's doing, because it's the type of filmmaking that I think requires multiple watches, mostly. I don't think I've seen really any Kelly Reichardt films that I immediately loved or understood as well as I did after I watched them multiple times, because they want you to observe things and not just plot or characterization, but like tiny little details that can make you see things completely differently. And that's what happened to me when I saw Meek's Cutoff and then wrote about it.
I remember on one of our past episodes with Lena Wilson, she said something really incisive, which was about how we don't know how to read stories about women because we don't have a lot of them. And I think Kelly Reichardt and Naomi Kawase are challenging because they're asking you to see the world in a way that's different from mainstream or even art house male cinema, which means you have to work to understand it. And we're not used to reading those images. And that's part of why it can take two viewings to like really get it. And then, of course, they're great films, so you can watch them 20 times and get new things out of them every time.
And not hate that you have to watch them many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why if you were a man watching a Kelly Reichardt movie, you would have trouble empathizing with the characters or figuring out why the characters are acting the way that they act. Where I think if, not that all of her films are about women, but a lot of them are, and even the ones that are about men, I think have a certain female perspective that just, as you say, requires additional hurdle for viewership, even for like female viewers. I think it's, she's making films in a different way from definitely the mainstream, but all other tenets of cinema as well. And you have to like train yourself to watch them. And I realize that makes it sound like it's going to be like a chore or like homework to watch her movies. It's not, but it does require more upfront introspection, getting your mind right.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because for all of her films except her first one, River of Grass, and Certain Women, which was adapted from Miley Malloy's short story, she's been working with the novelist John Raymond, either working with him to adapt one of his short stories or novels for the screen, or writing an original screenplay with him. And he is a Jewish man in the Pacific Northwest. So he's already like got a kind of outsider perspective on like masculinity, at least. And then you couple him with this woman from Florida, and they tell these stories about men and women in the Pacific Northwest, and you suddenly get like new perspectives on that. Like, not even just new perspectives on men and women, but on these particular contexts, I think. Sorry, Lindsay, I didn't mean to interrupt you on your thoughts about why it can take a bit to come around to her. But what do you feel like you gain from putting that time in?
I mean, I think like with Meek's Cutoff, just realizing how horrible it would be to be a woman in that scenario, the things that you are relegated to, that are your only thing that you can do when you're in this helpless situation, like this idea that you're still forced into a certain position as the world is on fire around you and everything is falling apart, even though it's a very specific scenario in the film, it's something intensely relatable, especially now as reproductive rights are stripped away from Americans. I hadn't really thought about it that much until I wrote about it. You know, the fact that you see the women preparing the meals and kind of doing all the work at camps and doing all the practical stuff on the trip. I think that's something that if you're just watching it one time or you're not really focusing in on that, you just kind of see it as part of the world building, maybe. Like, you don't see it as very intentionally communicating something about what those people were relegated to in their position and how it is, like, actually pretty crucial for understanding the film as a whole.
Yeah, I remember, I think I was reading an interview with Kelly Reichardt a while ago where she's talking about Night Moves, because there's a scene in that where they have to like lift all of these this fertilizer around, and Jesse Eisenberg was like, I'm an actor, why are you making me lift, can I lift like empty bags, do you really need me to lift these for like 20 minutes? And she was like, Yes, I do. I'm showing process here. And he was like, but I'm an actor. Why are you making me do this? I feel like that is a kind of nice dovetail to what you're saying there. Like, it requires you to sit with it and think about it much in the Ackerman way.
But she does have this really rewarding way of observing quite mundane things. Like, I remember talking to my dad about certain women, which I think was the first film that he saw of hers. And he was like, I don't know what it was, but I could have just watched Lily Gladstone cleaning out a stable for, like, hours. Like, there's just, like, scenes of her, like, cleaning out, like, horse shit from a stable and, like, putting, like, feeding the horses and just doing, like, everyday stuff.
Yeah.
And it's true that it is. There are some filmmakers who could show that and I'd get impatient. And then there's Kelly Reichardt who, like, focuses on just the right details for you to, like, be really drawn in by it and to find it quite poetic in a way and to really, like, be interested in this person and the rhythms of their life. And, you know, it reminds me of, like I said, like, the conversation we had about, like, Jean Dielman and why that film was so influential is because it, like, lends importance to these mundane everyday actions that wouldn't normally be considered worthy of screen time and makes them interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And also urges the audience to find them interesting, to find the things that are interesting about them. You know, that's why I think part of, I mean, obviously, like, Meek's cutoff, Lindsay's essay is so much about that, like, about how we're shown in the film the women's work of, like, collecting water and stuff like that, while the men are in the background, like, planning this expedition, which in most Westerns is the thing that we would be shown in the foreground as the primary action. But it's secondary action in this film. And then we later learn that actually water becomes the crux of the film. Like,
yeah.
Water is the thing that they run out of and that might kill them, the lack of water. And water is the thing the women were in charge of. And ultimately, whatever the men were doing becomes secondary to what that women's work was. And now the fact that it's missing is crucial.
Yeah, I think Reichardt's other interests throughout her films, but I guess is maybe most clear in Wendy and Lucy and in First Cow, is what it's like to not have any social support systems in place, which is something that, you know, makes her in line too with another American filmmaker, Deborah Granick, who we also wrote a book on her about her film Leave No Trace, which is in the director's Fortnite. But I think that's a challenging topic, and I think those two films are really part of where the title of our ebook, because it's Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams. I think those two are the films that are, like, the strongest broken American dreams, where you have the first time that Kelly Reichardt worked with Michelle Williams, which was in Wendy and Lucy, and that screened in Estelle Tamragar. You have a woman who is on a road trip across country trying to get to Alaska with her only friend, her dog, and just runs into one trouble after another, which makes her situation worse and worse and worse and worse, and she has absolutely no recourse, no family, no money to fall back on, no social support from the government or system around her. She sort of has to rely on the kindness or vague indifference instead of cruelty of strangers. And, you know, bit by bit, we watch her lose everything, including her dog, Lucy. And we see how much of that is because of, like, capitalist systems that are designed to work against her. And then, of course, she follows that up, I think, with First Cow, which takes us way back to early capitalism in the U.S. At one of the first Oregon outposts, and is about, you know, the key line that we quote all the time in the book is, there's no way for a poor man to make a start in this world, which is what King Lou says. And that's how the two lead character is King Lu, who is a Chinese immigrant, and Cookie, who is a Jewish man from Maryland, I think, that end up in Oregon. They decide they're going to start a business making baked goods that require milk, and the first cow has just been shipped into Oregon, so they're going to have to steal milk from the cow, which is owned by the man who presides over the outpost, the chief factor. And, well, you can imagine that there's a limit to how long they can get away with that. And the film is really incisive about how not fair that is, I guess, like that their crime, it really shows. And I think Wendy and Lucy shows this too, like they both are films about quote unquote criminals who quote unquote commit a crime, but they're crimes that hurt nobody. And in the case of First Cow, they actually bring pleasure to everyone, including the man they're stealing from. They've made his life better with their oily cakes.
You know, it's actually really hard to show, like, to tell stories about larger systems through personal stories.
Yeah.
And she, like, is doing it so well, kind of as good as anyone I can think of.
Well, I think she, Deborah Granick, and maybe Ken Loach are sort of the masters of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, she's just a master at, like, showing how capitalism works, but through character-based stories. So yeah. She's able to show the way a larger system is operating over all these people's lives, while also showing how individuals perpetuate that system and then get caught up in it, and how it's affecting everyone. And, like, I think First Cow is so excellent and just basically, like, using the situation of a period piece and, like, a small town to basically create, like, a microcosm of how capitalism works, and then create two characters that you really care for to show how that impacts them, and how there's a cycle with them stealing and then giving back to the community, and how that just does not work in a capitalist system.
This is part of the why I wonder as a filmmaker how much that comes into play with her own decision making, because she does, like, as we've said, she seems to be very introverted, quiet, observational, deeply interested in what these larger systems say about America and about people who operate within capitalism, etc. But then being a filmmaker and having to operate within a capitalist system, how do you think that impacts the decisions that she makes? Do you think that the interests in her film also affect how she operates as a filmmaker, and where she shows and where she doesn't?
I know it's difficult. It's almost kind of like difficult to ask those questions about filmmakers who are, like, struggling to even be allowed to make a film for, like, the smallest amount of money anyway, because they're just doing what they're able to.
Yeah, I mean, I think if, you know, Marvel said, "Hey, Kelly, we want you to direct the new whatever."
She'd say no.
Yeah, she would not. I would be floored, and it would change everything I thought I knew about her if she said yes.
I think she's not interested in that at all. And I think I remember a couple years ago, she was, like, developing a script, I think, with John Raymond that was a period piece, and I think it incorporated some elements of, like, fantasy sci-fi. That it sounded like it would require sort of a slightly larger scale of, like, budget of production design, of, you know, just production overall. And that was in development before First Cow was eventually made. So First Cow was basically, my impression is that they were trying to make that, and then funding fell through, and they had a slot of time where they were like, well, let's make something that's maybe slightly easier to do. And they started to develop First Cow, which is something that they've been thinking of for quite a while. It's a bit hazy, but that project never happened, essentially.
Yeah, well, First Cow was a problem too, because the book spans multiple countries, yeah, and time periods. So they'd been wanting to adapt that book for ever since they had met, and they couldn't figure out a way to do it that was going to be financially feasible until they figured out the cow, which is not even in the book. And then
yeah,
First Cow was born. So,
I mean, the cow was a way to, like, bring the idea of international trade to the film without, yeah, having to actually go to another country. So you could turn a film that takes place in multiple countries and timelines into a film that takes place in one timeline, essentially, and one small area. It turned it essentially into a Kelly Reichardt-sized film.
I mean, I feel like we don't talk generally enough about how filmmakers make their living. And I guess one of the nice things about Kelly Reichardt is because we know she has this other job, it's transparent. But I'm sure that the fact that she has a full-time teaching job that pays her bills gives her a lot of creative freedom. And the fact that she doesn't want to be a billionaire means that she doesn't have to accept Marvel. She doesn't have to make movies she doesn't want. And she can just not make a movie for 4 years if she can't get the funding and she won't be in the poorhouse. Filmmakers who sort of refuse to do something else other than just make their films, they might end up having to make more creative sacrifices, or they might just be lucky and white men.
I think she also just doesn't have, or she doesn't strike me as somebody who has any desire for fame. In my head, I place her on the same level with like Elena Ferrante, where if she could just be anonymous and say like, but let the work speak for itself, she would.
I mean, she has said that. I think there were, I've read many interviews with her where she sort of said like, I long for a life like Terrence Malick, who like never does press for his films and just like is a completely like remote person who doesn't have to be a public figure. And she was like, essentially, like, I'm a female filmmaker and my films are struggling as it is, and I really need to like get out there and promote them. I don't have the luxury not to do that, but if I did have the luxury not to do that, that's what I'd do. And perhaps she's changed her mind, because that was about, I think, 10 years ago that I, an interview from about 10 years ago, like Wendy and Lucy type time, that I read that. But she, you can sense that she sort of like happily goes along and does the press tour, but like she's not someone who has like social media and is out there like relentlessly promoting her stuff. And she's very reserved in terms of that, and she prefers to talk just sort of like about the work, and she doesn't really have an interest in like being like crafting an image for herself as an auteur, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it was after First Cow, where there was a video interview with her, and I got to see the inside of her house. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was because it was during the pandemic, so she was at home, and you could see, like, that was the most I've ever seen of her personal life, if you could even call it that. And it wasn't that revealing. And I mean, I think there were like some books, and maybe there was like art on the wall, but I don't know anything about her personal life. Has she said anything in interviews?
I mean, essentially, not really, aside from the fact that, you know, we know that she's like friends with Todd Haynes and Gus Van Sant, and we know that she like splits her time living between Portland, as of recently, and New York, where she teaches. But those are all related to her professional life, essentially. Like, otherwise, I think she basically keeps herself to herself, which is kind of nice with filmmakers.
Yeah, so
even though it makes me very curious.
I love it. I love to be curious about someone. I like them much more when I don't know things about them. And those
exactly.
And you can't even find those things. That's so appealing. An enigma.
I wouldn't want Kelly Reichardt to have a Sean Baker letterbox where she says,
no. No way. Even though I'm sure it would be amazing. I would
enjoy that.
I'm really like not being very kind to Sean Baker on this episode. I'm sorry, Sean Baker.
You could just do like what Steven Soderbergh does, which is release at the end of the year a list of everything he's watched and read. I would read that in like voraciously, but also it wouldn't be me, which would be kind of.
Yeah. It would be, it's interesting because you know, have no context of whether she liked the film. So you're just like, this is what Kelly Reichardt spends her time watching. Isn't that interesting? I imagine it's like 10 seasons of international Tops films. Model. Yeah, and also that. We have created a special box set of books that we previously wrote about women who have featured in the Cannes competition. The Women in Cannes competition box set includes books about three women directors who've been selected for the competition over the years. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and this year, Kelly Reichardt. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's C-A-N-N-E-S. On our Kelly Reichardt ebook, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, Claudio Alves of the Film Experience said, "As a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough." On our Celine Sciamma book, Portraits of Resistance, film critic Alfred Soto commented, "Erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed." On our Lynn Ramsey book, You Were Never Really Here, A Special Issue, Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com wrote, "Seventh Row's ebook allows for a deeper appreciation of a brilliant piece of art. It's what we want more from critical analysis, a conversation with the art and its creators, but so rarely get." Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/women-at-cannes.
So, I mean, when this episode drops, and at the time of recording, Showing Up has not yet premiered, so we've obviously not seen it, but we do know some things about it and her collaborators, and so maybe we can just talk a little bit about that, about her like ongoing collaboration with Michelle Williams, who stars, and the behind the scenes collaborators that we have spoken to that she works with. And is it really a pivot? Maybe we can start with, is it really a pivot that she's made a comedy?
Well, so it's been said that the film is a comedy, which we don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
Like, it's probably like a comedy to the extent that like The Worst Person in the World was a comedy, which is also a good comparison because like everyone's like, Joaquin Trier made a comedy, but all his films are like quite funny.
Yeah.
But the thing with Kelly Reichardt is I find her films more funny with every view.
Yes.
So like Night Moves is not a film I would have said was funny at all the first time I watched it, and then the second time you watch it when you like know what's up, it's
now
hilarious.
I think it's hilarious. Yeah,
it's really funny because you just know that these people have no idea what they're doing, which you don't understand the first time around, but with context, I mean, I think that's the genius of the comedy in her film, that it's so subtle that you kind of like, you need to understand the context. You need to understand like the subtle social cues that make it funny. I think it was only on like the third viewing of First Cow that I realized like, oh, there are like a ton of jokes in this. Like, I mean, like,
there's also a great scene when they are reunited in the bar, and there's a bar fight that's happening outside while they're like having a drink together and becoming friends, and you can see it through the window that somebody's getting beaten up while these two gentlemen are like, oh, it's so nice to see you again, let's be friends. It's really funny.
I always remember that quote that like from when, so Todd Haynes and Kelly Reichardt became friends, I think because she like worked in like the art department of Poison, I think. And he said of her that, like, he would, like, show up on set and, like, she was just, like, making everyone laugh. She was, like, the life of the party. Like, she was just, like, known to be, like, a really hilarious person. It's funny because it's not something that you'd, like, immediately associate with, A, her, like, public personality as seen in interviews. I mean, she is funny, but, like, she can, you know, she's just serious talking about her work. And she isn't like overly giving of herself to the public, and her films are quiet, and you can see them as quite like austere at first glance, but there's so much comedy like woven into them that the more familiar you become with her work, the more you realize that she has like a wicked sense of humor. I mean, Old Joy is like, I mean, it's excruciating, but also very funny.
Yeah. Well, and I always think about Jared Harris's line delivery of, I'm a guy in prison, which, I mean, of course, it's his performance makes it, but it's like, it's so great. Like, that's got to be one of the funniest scenes of the decade that I still regularly think about.
His name to me is now Jared.
I'm a guy in prison,
Harris.
Yes. Same. That's from Certain Women. Sorry to clarify. His wife leaves him for somebody. He gets arrested and in prison. And while in prison and getting visited by Laura Dern, he reveals that his wife left him for another guy in prison.
He said, I'm a guy in prison. You had to be there. Yeah, no, it, it, I, it makes me very curious as to like what the reactions to the new film as a comedy are going to be. Mm-hmm. Because I imagine it will be a similar thing with The Worst Person in the World, where we watch it and we're like, yeah, it's funny. Is it funnier than the other ones? Maybe in a different way, maybe more overtly, but not necessarily sort of funnier.
Yeah. Should we talk a bit about her team?
I mean, I'll say, like, there's not much known about the film. It was known to be like a film about like a woman played by Michelle Williams, who's a sculptor who's preparing for a show. But there's one image that has been released like for the Cannes premiere. But if you're in the know about Kelly Reichardt's collaborators and following April Napier, the costume designer's Instagram, as I am, as we all are, she will see that last July while they were shooting, or just after, she posted a bunch of behind the scenes pictures, which are like pretty delightful, mostly like her hanging out with Andre 3000. So I will link to those in the show notes. I wrote like a preview piece, sort of like rounding up everything we know so far about the film and included those in it. But they're pretty delightful. And April Napier, so a lot of her collaborators are coming back from First Cow and from previous films. Like April Napier, who did First Cow, Certain Women. Anthony Gasparri, the production designer, who did First Cow, Certain Women. And then, like, Christopher Blauvelt has been her DP since Meek's Cutoff. Who else? Like, there's a bunch of people she's worked with for a long time who are sort of, like, I mean, they sort of refer to...
I assume Leslie Schatz did the sound. Like, yeah. IMDb does not say, but IMDb thought First Cow was shot on 35mm, and then I asked Christopher Blauvelt about that, and he was like, what? No, it was shot digitally? Where'd they get that idea? So, wouldn't say IMDb's the most trusted source on this. I would guess that her sound designer, who's been working with her since, I think, Wendy and Lucy, Leslie Schatz, who has been doing terrific work on her films, is back.
And then, obviously, you've got Michelle Williams.
Yes.
Who was in Wendy and Lucy, Meek's Cutoff, Certain Women, and now showing up. So,
and
she is
John McGarrow, right? Who is,
yeah, so it's kind of like the last few films have like had this pattern of like lead actor in the next film, they're the supporting actor,
right?
So like Lily Gladstone was in Certain Women, and then she had like a small role in First Cow, and now John McGarrow was the lead of First Cow, and now he has what I assume is a small-ish role in this film. And you've got a couple of Reichardt regulars like James LeGros, shirt guy. You realize that in Night Moves and Certain Women, he like wears the same shirt.
Well, it's not exactly the same, but it's very, very similar. Like, I wondered if it was the same shirt or if that had been done deliberately. So I made you ask April Napier. She didn't do the costumes for Night Moves, but she did do the costumes for Certain Women. And I was like, what's the deal with this shirt?
and it was not on purpose. So it's just like, generally, James LeGros screamed out as a guy who should wear that shirt.
He should just wear like a beige kind of flannel shirt with pockets. Just like James, beige shirt with flannel shirt with pockets LeGros. Just like, you've got Jared, I'm a Guy in Prison Harris.
And then we have, I believe Larry Fessenden is in it. He's not listed on IMDb, but he's listed elsewhere, and he is a long-term friend of Kelly Reichardt's, and also like their collaboration dates back to, he was the lead of River of Grass and he edited River of Grass.
Yeah, he taught her how to edit, and she now
she's edited all her films since
yeah,
she is an editor. And then you've got a bunch of Reichardt newcomers like Andre 3000 and Hong Chow is in it as well.
Oh, right.
Judd Hirsch. So there's a bunch of people in the movie. Yeah, like usual, it's sort of a mix of regulars and newcomers. But Michelle Williams is really like, you know, I don't know if like she's her most frequent collaborator. I think she might be. I mean, I know there are a lot of character actors who show up in a lot of Reichardt films, but certainly prominently, she and Reichardt are known to be a bit of a duo, and with this film she'll have been in half of her features.
I think James LeGros has been in, this is his third, I want to say. Maybe it's four. And third, there's a couple other people who have been in like three or so, but not in prominent roles, like Michelle Williams.
And Michelle Williams is like, is also, as well as like them like bringing out the best in each other, like I think she's a really useful collaborator for Kelly Reichardt because she is legitimately a star.
But funnily enough, because they met, right, like when Wendy and Lucy was made, that was not that long after Dawson's Creek. Like she was not the Oscar nominated feted movie star.
She was Oscar nominated, was she? Wasn't she? Well, because she got her Oscar nomination in 2005. And Wendy and Lucy was released in 2008. Oh, right. I guess that was
Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
Okay. So she, okay. Fair, but it was still pretty early in her career because I think her first, like, non-Dawson's Creek part was The Station Agent in 2003. So she was not, like, a celebrity the way she is now.
Yeah, but, like, as both of their careers have grown in different ways, like, them remaining, like, a collaboration has definitely, like, I think it's sort of, like, given Michelle Williams some roles that she can really, like, sink her teeth into.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's also, like,
I mean, she's done probably her best work with Kelly Reichardt.
Yeah, I think so. But then also it's like, given Kelly Reichardt someone to put in her movies who, like, is going to get, like, investors and audiences interested in the sense that, like, if this was a more unknown actor, I question if she would have been in the Cannes competition.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because, like, the competition is really interested in sort of, like, putting stars on their red carpet.
Yeah.
And Michelle Williams, like, helps make that a thing.
I do think it's just, like, important to just talk a little bit about her collaborators because I think, like, any filmmaker, it's not a one-woman show even though Kelly Reichardt is her own editor. I mean, I love all of her films, but I do think we all agree that, like, certain women in First Cow are just kind of on another level.
I mean, I think that, like, even though their scales are still very small, they're, like, structurally and storytelling-wise quite a bit more ambitious.
Yeah. And I guess I just wanted to, you know, give a shout out to her collaborators because I don't think it's possible to make films that rich. I hesitate to say dense because they are kind of dense with ideas, but they feel sparse, which is a weird thing to manage to do both of. But
I mean, but it's why, like, the first time you watch her films, it feels like not a ton has happened. And then the more you watch it, you realize just how much is happening. It's like this really fascinating balancing act that, like, so few people can pull off.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's not like you watch it once and you were like, oh, there's so much going on there. Like, I'm going to have to, like, it's going to take so many viewings to catch everything. You think, how could I not have caught everything? It was just some people walking around, having some feelings. And then you realize that, oh, wait, there was that thing going on in the background that I didn't realize. And that thing connects to that thing. And I hadn't figured that out. And, like, this gesture is really meaningful. And this particular word someone used is, like, it all starts to click together in a way that you didn't even kind of realize that there was something there for you to realize until you sit with it and you revisit it.
But I do think, like something that some of our interviews and essays brought out in the book is how much information you get because of those collaborators. Like, I think about that great interview you did with April Napier on the costumes in Certain Women, and the essay you wrote about how this is a film about women in the world and how they're perceived and what they wear and how they wear it is such an important part of that. And, you know, that is April Napier, the costume designer's job, in collaboration with the actors. And that's a huge part of the film. And then, you know, I wrote an essay on Certain Women, which was more about the blocking and the framing and the ways that the characters break personal and cinematic boundaries. And, you know, that's a pure directing thing. But it's just the idea that these films work on multiple levels. And that's partly thanks to the collaborators. And I guess that's why we sort of, when we write our books, we like to talk to the collaborators of a filmmaker because they have pieces of the story that, you know, like, the filmmaker can't do all of those details, right? They're one person, and their job is to be the head of the team and keep it all cohesive and make sure they're making the same movie. And I don't know that you can totally understand a Kelly Reichardt film just by talking to Kelly Reichardt. You have to talk to her collaborators or read interviews with her collaborators and to understand the process. And then that's a big part of the storytelling. And I guess that's what you get in the book, is those insights from her whole team. And that team, I mean, we were talking to that team about First Cow and certain women, and in the case of Christopher Blovell, it's also about Meek's Cutoff and Night Moves, but they're all back for, and I guess Leslie Schatz also did Wendy and Lucy as well, dating back to that, but they're all back for showing up. So it's kind of like, if you want to know how would a film like that get made, our book Roads to Nowhere is really the answer to that.
I mean, and I think it says a lot about her that she's worked with so many of the same people over and over again, and that makes reading the interviews and buying the book all the better, because you can really get a sense of not only how she's progressed as a filmmaker and the things that are important to her, but how her collaborations have pushed her to where she is now. So if you're really trying to understand Kelly Reichardt as a filmmaker, yeah, you need all of those disparate pieces, and the book has so many interviews and essays, and there's no other place where you can get everything all in one place like that, in a format that you actually will want to read and isn't like a very dense and boring book you'd buy for school.
I think, and when we were talking about the capitalism stuff, I mean, Orla, you wrote a great essay on First Cow and how it, you know, is a story about the structural problems of capitalism. And then Angelo Moretta wrote an essay about Wendy and Lucy and how it deals with some similar themes as well.
I found it really quite hard to write that essay. Like, it took quite a while and several views of the film.
Yeah.
For the reasons we've talked about, that, like, you know, I had my impression of how the film deals with capitalist systems the first time I watched it. And then I watched it again and I realized, wow, there's so much more going on. Like, there's so many more layers to the way that it's like laying out this system.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched it again and I realized how many details there were that added to that, even still, like how so many times when we're introduced to a new location in the town, the first shots are of goods or money exchanging hands, and just all sorts of things that kind of just hint towards the idea of like commerce above all and money like ruling the way interactions work in this town. It's just all sorts of stuff that like had to be incorporated into this essay, which is why it took a while to write, but I think it packs all of that into it as it is. So if you don't want to watch the film like 5 billion times, but you want to understand all those insights, I'd recommend reading that, because I mean, we did a lot of the work for you with like really studying these films, because like we said, you really have to study them to fully understand them, because there's really so much going on that like you might not even realize that you're missing.
Yeah, and I think these films are, what's rewarding about them is they give you so much to think about, like intellectually and emotionally, and it's a lot to unpack. And I know like one of the reasons we started writing these books is because I was a lonely viewer watching like small movies that nobody else had seen and that nobody had written more than 3 paragraphs on. And I was frustrated that I didn't have a way to unpack these films and think more deeply about them or have anybody else talk me through them. And our books are sort of are now meant to be that for the world, for the filmmakers and the films that we decide to focus on, I think. I mean, for me, like, I loved certain women going into writing this book. I loved certain women. I wouldn't say I was, like, a Kelly Reichardt super fan. I had, like, I liked some of her films and felt less great about others. And then by the end of the film, by the end of writing the book, especially by reading other people's essays and doing these interviews, now I am a Kelly Reichardt super fan. So if you're, like, on the fence because you're like, I don't know, I liked one of her movies, well...
And that's the coolest thing about art, when you get new information and it allows you to see something in a totally different way, that makes it really exciting. And I think that, yeah, unless you want to watch the film a billion times, this book is going to help you do that in an easier way. And it's going to give you a conversation that you can kind of have while reading it. It will engage you and it will make you think about things, and it will bring you to a new and different perspective, maybe one that isn't even represented in the book. So I think that it's valuable for that reason. If you like getting more information and learning about how to process and understand film on a deeper level, this will help you do that.
So if you want to get the book, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, which is at the moment just available as an ebook, you'll get it as an EPUB and a PDF. You can do so on our website at reichartbook.com. And it's also part of our Women in Cannes box set, which is a limited time deal where we've packaged three of our books on three filmmakers whose films have been in the Cannes competition. Kelly Reichardt, who's there this year, Celine Sciamma, whose film Portrait of a Lady on Fire was in competition in 2019, and Lynn Ramsey, whose You Were Never Really Here was in competition. So we have books on all of them and their processes, and you can get them all together at a discount, three books for the price of two, through our Women in Cannes box set. If you want to do that, there's a link in the show notes. You can also go to our website, 7th-row.com. There's a big Women in Cannes option in the menu, which will send you to all the information about this season and also our box set and those books. So yeah, I guess in conclusion, we're really excited about showing up. We hope that it's beloved and well-received, and we think it's great that Cannes is finally recognizing Kelly Reichardt with a much...
Deserved,
yes, with a much deserved slot in the competition.
Yes, and mate, I don't want to jinx it, but at this point I do feel like she's incapable of making a bad / uninteresting film.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty optimistic about it, and I'm jealous of all the people who are going to get to see it.
So I think that's the end of our discussion on Kelly Reichardt. We will be back next week for the third episode of our Women in the Cannes competition season to talk about Celine Sciamma and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, who we also wrote a book on, including that film, and talk about her history with the Cannes Film Festival. And then in our final episode on June 1st, in 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Naomi Kawase, who we've been calling the darling of Cannes, and who we think is a, despite being the darling of Cannes, is still criminally underappreciated. And so this is part of our work to try and help correct that. Lindsay, where can people find you, including on the airwaves, because you have a new podcast?
That is true. Yes. So you can find me at womaninrevolt.com, or if you want to listen to my podcast, it's just Woman in Revolt podcast on all the usual places. And it's with my sort of like mother figure mentor who is like 26 years older than me. So she's always been very into film, and we have really great discussions all the time, and just decided to start recording them. And it's kind of a little all over the place. We're going to do some old movies, some new movies, but they're always discussions that center women in some capacity. So if that is a thing you're into, perhaps you should listen.
Well, and your first episode is on Anaïs in Love, which was in the Critics Week last year at Cannes and is directed by a woman.
It is, and it's a film that Seventh Row introduced me to, so look at that.
Yeah, I love that film. Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at Orla Mango on Twitter. You can find my writing on Seventh Row, and you can find me every week on this podcast.
And you can find me on Twitter at BWestCineast, BWestCineaste. You can find my writing on Seventh Row and me on this podcast every week. Make sure that you subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss the rest of the Women in Cannes competition season. And if you have yet to do so, do catch up with our first episode where we do a rundown of the history of women at Cannes over the years, which I found very illuminating. We also, I mean, part of the purpose of this podcast is we want to generate a conversation about women, you know, celebrating the great achievements of women in the Cannes competition and at Cannes more generally this year, and also bring attention to the fact that Cannes needs to change and grow up and get gender parity. So, you know, we're going to be tweeting some facts and things about it. You can, and if you want to follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Seventh Row, use the hashtag Women at Cannes. We will be posting about that and thinking about that and generating a conversation about that. We will also be doing the same thing via email. So if you want to get our emails, we will also be giving you recommendations for films directed by women that have screened at the Cannes Film Festival in the past, as well as, you know, updates on this podcast season and more. So if you'd like to get those updates, you can do so at email.7th-row.com/women@Cannes. We'll put a link to that in the show notes again, but that's a great way to stay updated on and get lots of great recommendations like Anaïs and Love for fantastic films we loved by women directors that have screened at Cannes recently and in the past. Okay, well, that's the end of this episode of the Women in Cannes competition season. We will see you, or I guess you will hear us, next week, we hope, for our episode on Celine Sciamma at Cannes. So tune in then. Thanks for listening.